This lecture, entitled Torah Part 4b, is dedicated to the honor and merit of the Zurah family. Now, although Hillel and the disciples embodied such remarkable love of humanity and humility, as we discussed in the previous lecture, the same could not be said about the generation in which they lived. According to Josephus, the Pharisees, the Perushim, those the Talmidim of the Tanoim, only numbered some 6,000 Torah scholars. That's all. The rest of the populace, although generally adherent to both the written and oral law, were hard-working, ignorant people, by and large, many of whom harbored resentment towards the Pharisees to what they interpreted to be a holier-than-thou attitude, as Tosaf explains in Ksubas, Samabez Amabez, in 62b. The hatred that the Amoraites had for the Talmidei Chachamim, Torah scholars described in the Gemara Psochim, Emtes Amabez, 49b, here we have the English on page 11. It was taught, Rabbi Kiva said, when I was an Amoraites, ignorant of the Torah, I said, I would that I had a Torah scholar, I wish I had a Torah scholar before me, I would maul him like a donkey. Says disciples to him, Rabbi, why didn't you say like a dog? He answered them, the former bites and breaks the bones, while the latter bites but does not break the bones. In other words, he would like to bite them to break the bones. It was taught, Rebbe Eliezer said, this is further on in the Gemara, but that we are necessary to them for trade, they would kill us. Evidently the animosity was so intense. And further on it says, greater is the hatred wherewith the Amoraites hate the scholar than the hatred wherewith the heathens, the Goyim, hate Israel. And their wives hate even more than they. It was taught, says, he who has studied and then abandoned the Torah hates a scholar more than all of them. In addition, amongst the common folk, there was a movement to topple Roman rule and gain independence. This is described by Josephus in his Antiquities, Book 18, in the following manner, here on paragraph B. But of the fourth sect of Jewish philosophy, Judas, Yehuda, of the Galilean, was the author. These men agree in all other things with the Pharisaic notions. In other words, the three sects are the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Sadducim, and the Essenes, which we discussed at length before. But this fourth one agreed in terms of the religious philosophy, they agreed with the Pharisees. But they have an inviolable attachment to liberty and say that God is to be their only ruler and Lord. They also do not value dying, any kind of death, and are not afraid of dying. Nor indeed do they heed the deaths of their relations and friends, nor can any such fear make them call any man Lord. In other words, these were the people who were involved in the independence movement that brought about the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And since this immovable resolution of theirs is well known to a great many, I shall speak no further about that matter. Nor am I afraid that anything I have said of them should be disbelieved, but rather fear that what I have said is beneath the resolution they show when they undergo pain. In other words, I've just touched the tip of the iceberg. They really don't care about being tortured. They don't care about being killed. They have one goal, independence.
Did Hashem be the ruler, or was their own? It was like American independence.
Oh, you're asking about the yeah, no. They said they believed only the Ribbono Shel Olam. In other words, there shouldn't be any Roman rule. Of course, you know that they assuming Hashem is the ruler, says they have to follow halacha. So they need bali halacha. They need someone who are experts in in Jewish law, so to guide them, like similar to the period of the Shoftim, you know. But that's all they want. In other words, that they basically were. In a certain sense, it's one hears the echoes in the movement of of the Meir Kahana, Elav Hashalom, never again. We don't want the Goyim, we don't want the Arabs, we don't want, we're independent.
So they were denying the idea of Golos?
Right.
No Golos.
Right. So they're denying the idea of Golos. Right. This is the idea that we are in Golos. That the Mashiach has not come. We can't basically, as we can't take it in our hands. That's really what we discussed. That they're Sholosh Shavuos. That there are the three oaths. That being in Golos, we are commanded to accept Golos, to change ourselves to be fit to the Shabbat Geula. But that's what we do. But that was there. This was a fourth group. They were not Talmid Chachamim, mm-hmm. but they were religious Jews. In that sense. And then there was the scourge of the Sicarii. Assassins who simply kill those who supported Roman rule, described by Josephus in his War of the Jews, Book 2, in Chapter 13, his number C. When the country is purged of these, there sprang up another sort of robbers in Jerusalem, which were called Sicarii, who slew men in the daytime in the midst of the city. This they did chiefly at the festivals. When they mingled themselves among the multitude, concealed daggers under their garments. That's what the Lashon Sicarii. You remember the one who was the head of the Biryonim, the one of these described as the zealots, but those really of this independence party, was Abba Sikra, the master of the dagger. So these were the Sicarii. Sealed daggers under their garments, which they stabbed those that were their enemies. And when any fell down dead, the murderers became part of those that had indignation against them. By which means they appeared persons of such reputation they could by no means be discovered. In other words, when it occurred, and people say, hey, there's a murder here. So they would also say, hey, there's a murder here. What happened? We need justice. Where are the police? And they themselves, no one knew who they were. Because the people, it wasn't they went in broad daylight and just, when you gun down somebody, at least you hear the sound. You have the smoking gun. Here, they just came over to him, stabbed the person. Put back the dagger and started screaming, hey, there's somebody's been stabbed. The first man who was slain by them was John Yonason, the high priest, after whose death many were slain every day. While the fear men were of being so served was more afflicting than the calamity itself. Everyone lived in fear. While everybody expected death every hour, as men do in war, so men were obliged to look before them, take notice of their enemies at a great distance, nor if their friends were coming to them, durst they trust them any longer. And who knows who really is a friend? But in the midst of their suspicions, guarding themselves, they were slain. It didn't help. Such was the celerity of the plotters against them, and so cunning was their contrivance. That's how Josephus describes it.
So this group also had that shita, they're denying Golos?
That's right.
And they were killing Yidden and Goyim?
No, they were killing, they say, these people, were the thing that we need independence now,
right.
and they were killing those who they felt were part of the enemy.
To work with the Romans.
That's right. And if that was not enough, Josephus makes mention of the following phenomenon. I just want to explain what the situation was by the time of the Churban HaBayis. There was also another body of wicked men gotten together, not so impure in their actions, but more wicked in their intentions, which laid waste the happy state of the city no less than did these murders. These were such men as deceived and deluded the people under the pretense of divine inspiration, but were for procuring innovations and changes of the government. And these prevailed with the multitude to act like madmen, and as they claimed they're the Mashiach, really. You know, they're going to go and save everyone. And went before them into the wilderness, pretending that God would there show them the signals of liberty. But Felix, he was a Roman procurator. In other words, he was the head of the Roman government in Judea, thought this procedure was to be the beginning of revolts. We sent some horsemen and footmen, both armed, who destroyed a great number of them. In other words, there were all kinds of interesting, like there are what we call crazed movements during this time. So we give a sense of the period.
What?
He doesn't know. I mean, he wrote this in Greek, so I don't know. The Gemara does not. We have the Bir Yonim, but these Bir Yonim, which were who are the freedom fighters. We don't have a name for the Sicarii, even though we do know, but not exactly this, that 40 years before the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, before the Temple, the Sanhedrin, and really all of the Sanhedrin, ceased judging capital crimes, din and nefoshes, and they moved from their place in the Beis Hamikdash, within the facilities of the Beis Hamikdash. They had a special room, the Lishkas HaGozes, the room of hewn stone, and they moved to a place on the Har HaBayis in the Temple Mount. So this is called Chanuyos, the stores, and that's where they were. And because they had left the proximity of the Beis HaMikdash and the Mizbeach and the altar, they no longer were qualified, they nor any of the minor courts, to deal in capital crimes. And they did this because there were so many murders that they could not really deal with this. And I guess because of the corruption and because of the Romans, they said, listen, we're leaving through Ribono Shel Olam. We can no longer deal with this. We're not going to be held responsible. So we know about murders in general, this particular thing, that really, there it was like impossible, even what he's describing, even to bring them to court, simply because there's no witnesses. In the other case where they stopped, there were witnesses, but people were either afraid to come, or people were afraid of what would happen. So that's where they stopped dealing with this. It was in this unsettled period where many longed for the final redemption that Christianity was also gaining adherence amongst the unlettered within the Jewish community. This was the atmosphere. You know, it's not, with this background, one can perhaps better understand at least the narrative that's described in the New Testament, that the reason that the Romans killed Yeshu, according to their version of the story, at the behest of the Sanhedrin, which was really, it's clear, was not the Sanhedrin, at least how it's described. It was not the Sanhedrin that sat in a normative thing, 71 elders. And this was led by, this was a Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin really means a, like the word Senate, like it means an assembly. And it was led by the Kohen Gadol, who was part of the group of the Sadducees. So it was, it wasn't the Sanhedrin that we know of, but it was a group that handed him over to the Romans, and ostensibly because they were afraid that he was going to begin a rebellion. He claimed that he's the Messiah. So it's, we could understand in that atmosphere. Felix came many years later. We could understand that because of that fear that the Romans, Pontius Pilate, killed him. According to their version, we discussed in the previous lecture about there seems to be a person, this Ben Satada, that seems to be very closely related to the person described in the New Testament. And that already, that was killed not by the Romans, by the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin that was qualified of Talmid Chachamim. And it was during the period of time that Rabban Gamliel HaZaken was alive. So it was a whole different story. However, but we could understand the setting of their narrative in the, you know, in the backdrop of what's happening here. The literature of the Essene community in Qumran is also replete with messianic predictions. They have all kinds of literature they have, the scrolls. All of this hatred and murder within the general community, especially as it was directed towards the Pharisees, took its toll upon the Torah community as well, as we read. There. This is the Gemara here. Why was the second Sanhedrin destroyed? Seeing that in its time, this is the Moran Yuma in Tesomet Beis, Yoma says 9b, seeing at the time they were occupying themselves with Torah study, observing precepts, and the practice of charity. After reading what we have about all the murders, about all the majority being Amoraites, unlettered, what does it mean with Torah study? Through the precepts, practice of charity. And then it says, because therein prevailed hatred without a justifiable cause. It would seem to be that we're dealing with those who, with, in other words, there were enough people occupying themselves with Torah study, even though they're not the majority, that would justify the keeping the Beis HaMikdash, not destroying it, because you have this whole group of Torah scholars. Even the majority are not Torah scholars. And even it was filled with people who are murderers. And the Gemara in Sota says that 40 years before the destruction of the temple, they ceased using the Mechat, the Me Sota. In other words, going through the process of the Sota, because because immorality was so rife. And the Gemara says in Zainam Beis that the Me Sota only works if the husband himself is clean, and the family that he had is clean of immorality. If he does it or he tolerates it, it won't work. So at that point, it just didn't work. So they just Rabbi Yechem and Zakkai stopped it. So we're dealing with a lot of immorality. There's a lot of bloodshed. But those Talmid Chachamim were pure. So what was the problem? Because therein prevailed hatred without a justifiable cause. Sinas Chinam. That's why it was destroyed. That teaches you that a groundless hatred is considered as of even gravity, the same weight with the three sins, Avodah Zorah, idolatry, says Arayas, immorality, and Shvichas Damim, and bloodshed together. That's the Gemara. And one has to ask, it says, who did these, if we're assuming these are the same people who observed Torah observance, practice of charity, they were Nikiyim. And he says, and that's why, you know, the second Beis HaMikdash could not have been destroyed because of the reasons of the first Beis HaMikdash. Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of immorality. Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of bloodshed. No, so evidently it's not the Chachamim. But the question is, but over there, the Gemara says that at least the Havilah Limchos V'Leimocha, the Gemara says in Nun Hei and Shabbos, they at least tolerated the situation. But here, evidently, they didn't tolerate. In fact, it's interesting, again, as a historical document, you know, there are many critiques about the New Testament being historically accurate. However, one could understand the setting of the writing and the feeling of the authors and their understanding of the Pharisees. The Pharisees are constantly giving the Amaratzim Musar. They're constantly, you know, reproving, rebuking the Amiorites. That's the whole story that they, in terms of the kashrus, was not justified, you know, and Yeshu was quoted as saying, better that which comes out of the mouth than what comes in the mouth. They'd be more nizer in Lashon Hora than in Macholas Asuras, in other words, more careful. You know, this is the quote, but evidently it's indicative of the Pharisees that they viewed, says, were people that gave them Musar. So the problem of that occurred in the first Beis HaMikdash, that they, by their quietness, you know, by just being quiet, they were considered in a certain sense as being accomplices. I think most heavily limchos v'lemocha, that did not occur in the second Beis HaMikdash. That's what it would seem. That was not the problem. And within themselves, they were good people. So where was it? The Sinas Chinam. And one has to say, where was the Sinas Chinam directed to? Where was the Sinas Chinam? To whom? One can't, in other words, we don't have enough information. But one, there's, I think, sufficient grounds to say that we know amongst the Pharisees, if there would be two groups that were at odds with each other, there would be Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Sometimes it says that it led almost to bloodshed. As the Yerushalmi describes when they made the Yud Ches Devorim, the 18 decrees, that they stuck a sword in the ground. You know, that they were adamant, no one should leave, and we have to come to a, you know, the quorum and to make a vote over here regarding these decrees. It was very passionate. So, in a certain sense, one could say that they were polar opposites. Yet the Mishnah says in Yud Gimel and Beis and Yevamos, and the Gemara, and there's a Brisa that expands it in Yud Dalet and Beis and Yevamos, that they loved each other. They got married amongst each other. They were mechutonim. As the Gemara says, that there were Ava and Sholem between them. So it's very hard to say. So who were these Pharisees hating? The people of Oisik, these are tzaddikim. They're Oisik in Torah, mitzvahs, gemilas chasodim. They didn't seem to hate each other. So who were they hating? The Gemara speaks about, there's a Gemara in Yud Gimel, Kuf Yud Gimel, Mabez, and Psachim, about three sets who hate each other. And it was Talmid HaChomim and Bavel. In Babylon, it seems that there was very passionate, the two sides, different than Meshama and Mesil. But that was not the case in Eretz Yisrael. I care in Eretz Yisrael. There's a Gemara Chof Dalet in Sanhedrin that speaks about them like they're smooth, like oil, whatever it is. They're Noyach Lahem. So who do they hate? It would seem that they hate the Amaratzim. Those are the ones they hated. In a certain sense, you could say it was justified. Like we quoted before, he said, If they needed us, they would kill us. So it's hard to, you know, where was this Sinas Chinam? To me, it would seem, at least based on the Tosfos and Psachim and Kuf Yud Gimel Amud Beis, we have a better understanding of this. and I've said this in a previous lecture. The Gemara says, if I see somebody who does an avera, someone who does something wrong, and it's bemazed, he willfully does this avera, he's warned, he knows it's wrong, and he does this, I am not allowed, since I'm an Eid Echad, I'm only the sole witness, I cannot go to Beis Din and tell them that he has done this and this crime. It's Lashon Hara. In fact, the Gemara describes a situation, someone did this, and actually the person, not the perpetrator, but the one who went to Beis Din and told on him was flogged. Because it's merely Lashon Hara, you have no right to say this. Yet the Gemara says, it's true, I cannot tell Beis Din, but I have the right to hate him. So Russia. Now, the machloek is, am I allowed to hate him? And others, I'm required to hate him. Based on that Gemara, Tosfos asked, the Gemara justice finds the source of this, that where do we find that a person would be allowed to hate another Jew? When it speaks about that, I see, says that they have someone is taking his goods to market, and there's a problem there with the burden on this, and he needs help. You have to go and help him, but it's described sainacha, when you see your enemy. And the Gemara asks, what do you mean your enemy? If you have no right, as a personal vendetta, you have no right to hate him. This is not one factor, one way or another. He's a Jew. Why mention even the fact? And why mention he did an avera that he hated him? It has no bearing on the case. If he's a Jew and he needs help, you have to help him. So the Gemara says, I must be speaking about a case that I have a right to hate him, but nobody else has the right to hate him, because then he's everybody's. If he's a Russia, then it's not your personal one that you hate. It's everyone hates him. Everyone's either allowed or required. It must be, says, that I saw him do something I'm not allowed to tell. That's how the Gemara learns. And therefore, it's my personal one that I hate, and I'm allowed to hate or required to hate, but no one else's. So Tosfos asks the Kasha, Tosfos over there in Pesachim, Kuf Yud Gimel Amud Beis, from a Gemara in Bava Metzia and Lamed Beis Amud Beis. There the Gemara speaks about the following scenario. We spoke about an animal that's under, or the owner of the animal is under duress. And there are two scenarios. Either the load is too heavy for the animal, it's too heavy for the owner to take it off himself, and if left on the animal could perish, I mean, or be broken because of the undue stress of the burden. That's one scenario. That's mainly I'm required to take off the load. It's called prika. The other scenario is that the load has fallen off and it has to be reloaded. So it's no stress on the animal, but onto the owner also. There's a question, has to come to market, whatever it is. There's a loss for the owner. That's called te'ina, to put it back. Under normal circumstances, if I have two animals here, two people with two animals, one needs to help to remove the burden, prika. One needs help to put on the burden, the load. That's tina. Prika comes first. It's tsar balechayim. It's a pain for the animal, which is a factor. It's a loss of money for the thing of the not just bring to market, the loss of the donkey, of the whatever animal is carrying it. So normally prika has kadima, has precedence. However, if the one that for prika is my friend, and the one who needs to just be loaded is my enemy, then the enemy takes precedence. Even though both things by themselves, if you look at them, the in terms of what precedence, there's a greater need to be unloaded in that case than to be loaded. However, kedei lochav es yitzroi, in order to subdue his yetzahora, that he has someone that he hates, since he's not allowed to have someone he hates, so that for that purpose, says that's why then the te'ina, helping my enemy, has precedence. That's the Gemara. So Tosfos and Bava Metzi asked the question, what do you mean? He says, what do you mean, your enemy? You're not, you know, you're not supposed to hate. The Pasuk is speaking about a person who's a Rasha. So Tosfos answered, no, this case is not the case that the Pasuk speaks about. This is just your own personal, you shouldn't have talked out of an enemy. Not what the Pasuk is speaking about. You have your personal enemy. You should not have had him an enemy. You have him as an enemy. And it's telling you what to do. How to get the hatred out of you. Tosfos and Bava in Pesachim has a different view. Takes a different approach. And he says that no, we're speaking about the same enemy. The same enemy of the Pasuk. The question is, I have the right to hate him. What do you mean, Kei Loch of his Yitzray? I should subdue the Yitzray Hora. So Tosfos says, basing himself on a Gemara in Kuf Yud Zayin Amud Aleph in Yevamos, when someone hates you, you automatically hate him back. Kamayim ponim el ponim, just like water reflects an image. He says, you feel the hatred in his heart, and you feel it. It comes to you, and you automatically feel that resonates, and you hate him back. So your hatred is a reflection of his hatred. So even if, so he says, based on that, you started hating him because he is a Russia. He's a criminal. Now he feels it, and he's going to hate you back. Now since he hates you back, you're going to hate him back in kind. Because you hate anybody who hates you. Now it goes beyond the rishis that he did and the criminality and the avera that he did. This is a personal hatred. This becomes a personal thing. Way beyond the original thing. The Gemara in Bava Metzia says, how do you get that hatred out of you? Not the original hatred. That original hatred has a gvul. It comes from a love of Hashem. It's intolerance of criminals. But the personal hatred is that you have to get rid of. That's how Tosfos and Pesachim learns this. But Al Kaponim, you see from the Tosfos and Pesachim that those who hate you, there's a normal thing to hate them back. The Purushim, the Pharisees, had many people who hated them. The Sadducees hated them. Okay. The Amoratsim hated them. A lot of people hated them. The Amoratsim, you could say, is Megedra Tinik Shenishba. If they were unlearned, probably their parents were unlearned, their grandparents were unlearned. And the attitudes that they had were probably what they picked up in their home. Like the Gemara says in the end of Sukkah, in the Vovon Beis, Shusa didi nuka bishuka, Abba, Bima. See a little kid talking in the marketplace. So he says he got it from his home. He's already opinionated, and he has opinions. Those are the opinions he picked up in his home. Whatever it is, but there's a sina that you have. It would seem to me that the sina schinim that we're talking about here is about the hatred that they had towards the Amoratsim. And the problem with that kind of hatred is, I mean, beyond hatred in general. But hatred in general, I mean, is a problem. The Gemara says, Alamed Beis, and really the Chofetz Chaim himself, he goes a different direction, is really sensitive to the fact that the Beis Midrash was chora because of Sinas Chinam, and this is equal to all the three Averas. And he says, you know, Sinas Chinam is not so bad. The Gemara says, Alamed Beis, and Shabbat, he doesn't quote the Gemara, but the Gemara has a whole list of Averas. Mekal al Chomor, about what that meant. The Chomer is Shvichas Domim, the Shechina leaves, Avodah Zorah and Gilei Raos, Beis HaMikdash. I mean, it has all of these things of what occurs. It begins with Sinas Shechinim. That seems to be the lightest of them. And the what comes out of Sinas Shechinim is Rachman al-San, that one has, there's dissonance, there's argumentation within the house at your own home. You know, that Chas V'Shalom children die. But that's the beginning of a whole list. But the Beis HaMikdash, that's left for the more Chomer Dikah Averas, it would seem. So then why is it so chomer? And this is really, that's a Chofetz Chaim sense of in the beginning, and there's Agdoma to Chofetz Chaim. So he says, therefore, it must have been because of Lashon Hara, even though the Gemara does not really say the words Lashon Hara. But we know Lashon Hara is so chomer. That we know from multiple sources. But he assumes that the Sinas Chinam here is also Lashon Hara, even though the Gemara does not say those words Lashon Hara. I'd perhaps say different, because the problem is for it, it says Sinas Chinam. You know, it doesn't say Lashon Hara. But plenty of Gemara's and Gemara. Erechen is a whole thing. Riches and Daftar Zion, and you know about Lashon Hara, the Sugi means Tezvov and Beis, the Zion Amar Aleph. All Riches about Lashon Hara. Could have said Lashon Hara. Doesn't say it says Sinas Kinam. It seems the scene itself is which is seen on the surface a problem. You know, we quoted before, it says last, about Hillel. Hillel's the first of his many statements is. This is one should be Oyev Shalom, Roydev Shalom, Oyev is Abriyas Makarv on the Torah. That was his. That was Hillel's motto. If what I'm saying is true, that the Sinas Chinam is like that Tosfos, and he came to all these Amaratzim. It says a person is oyev abrius, be makar of lateris, an outgrowth of being oyev abrius. You love them, says you. You're worried about their welfare. You're not worried just about their physical material welfare. They're about their spiritual welfare, and you're makar of them to Torah. Says but someone if it starts off that they hated the Amayaretz hated the Talmid HaChachamim because, at least according to the words of Tosfos and Ksubas and Samach Beis on Beis, they felt that they were arrogant, they were looking down at them. But all of this was reinforced if the Chachamim hated the Amayaretz back. So that really reinforced that they hate them. You look down at us. We're not good enough for you. But if they would all be like Hillel, they're not a good target to hate. They have to be a target. You know, you see a person who's a Baal Tzedakah and a Baal Chesed and just loves everybody, hard to hate such a person. Just hard. You know, it could very well be that, you know, that had they had them, they all have had the midah of Hillel, this oyev es abrius and makarv on the Torah, the oyev shalom v'roid of shalom, it would have had a profound effect on the populace as a whole. But with sinas chinam, that it goes beyond the averas that the Amorites may do, or the just goes on, already you have no hope. So in a certain sense, you had 6,000, or maybe it was, maybe these were the elite, you know, maybe there were more, but still seems to be a decided minority of the population. There were Talmid HaChachamim. But there was, if there would have been more love, there would have been a much more of a thing that it was Kedai for Hashem to keep. We're speaking about all this murder and the immorality discussed from the Gemara and Saita. You know, and we have the Sadducees, which are apokursim. And these Essenes were also apokursim. And there's Soyne Chachamim. You have all of these things, but it was enough to have this group of Talmid Chachamim that learned Torah, Isik B'Torah, and Chesed. So that was enough to keep the Beis HaMidrash going. Remember, the reason was that because there's always the hope that they'll bring everybody back. But with Sinas Chinam, there's no hope anymore. So really, in a sense, is that you left all of these people in this terrible city without any hope of bringing them back. I'm just saying perhaps that's a different way of looking at things, but perhaps historically we could understand this. But despite all of this, but Clausius was still blessed with inspired leadership, unusual people, during those difficult period. And first and foremost, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was a disciple of Hillel, who embodied his virtues, as we read here on paragraph F. It was said regarding Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, no one ever preceded him in giving the greeting of Shalom. Even a pagan, even a Nochri, his Beshukah on the marketplace. He'd always be the first one to say, Shalom Aleichem. You know, you see someone walk into a Beis Medrash, you don't know who he is. It really makes a difference if you go over to give a person Shalom. He feels like a somebody. Doesn't feel ignored. I mean, this goes into the, you know, into this whole thing that it creates Ahava. I remember when I first came to Lakewood, this is 1966, in the summer's month, and it was Yossel Kaufman. As I was on. Yossel Kaufman, this is the brother of Shmuel Kaufman, the uncle of the David Kaufman. He would give Shalom to everybody. Shalom Aleichem, what's your name? You know, he would mamish go over to everybody. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, they give Shalom to everybody. He was Magdim Shalom. Whole other. It was Magdim Shalom. And it really makes a difference. You're in a place, people, a stranger comes in, it makes him feel that it lifts up the spirits of a person. He's new, he's this, and you care about him. You're somebody. And it was he who guaranteed the survival of Torah in Eretz Yisrael, the survival of the Torah, in the aftermath of the death and destruction that occurred in the wake of the destruction of Yerushalayim. In Jerusalem and the Beis HaMikdash, the temples, we now read, and now this is the last quotation, on the bottom page 12, the Briyone, the ruffians, who were zealots, were then in the city. And these evidently they would be similar to that group that Josephus described, the fourth group. The rabbi said to them, let us go out and make peace with them, the Romans. But they would not let them. On the contrary, they said, let us go out and fight them. Like the historian Rav Isaac HaLevi explains, that basically is the Chazal, the Pharisees, understood that we were in Golus. This is Golus Roimi. It's one of the part of the Golus. But it didn't have to be so corrupt. They could have within the Golus, they could have, in a sense, created a sense of normalcy, of law and order, that there wouldn't be the massive corruption with the Kohanim Gedolim, who were Sadducees, who were in cahoots with the Romans. And Josephus tells about how they plundered and took advantage of the poor, you know, those who were less fortunate. They could have created, you know, a situation similar that we had quoted before, that the Jewish populace during the time of the Talmais, when it was under Egyptian rule, at the end of that were terrorized by a group of people led by a fellow named Yosef ben Tovil, who was a nephew of the Kohen Gadol Chonya. We described this in length. And he created a group of tax collectors who eventually was this group who led the all of Jewry astray. However, says when when there was a new government and the Egyptians were defeated and the Syrians took over, they were the Syrian king, Antiochus III, the father of the Antiochus of the Hanukkah story. They came, they were greeted by the Sanhedrin. And Rav Isaac HaLevi explains, and it's that time that the position of Nasi, this according to him, was created. And Nasi, he became like the king. He became just what the Kohen Gadol used to be, under the Egyptians. The Nasi now became the leader of Jewry, and was led by the Sanhedrin. Eventually, though, under Antiochus IV, in other words, the son. Again, corruption reigned. He was bribed. The Kohen Gadol was chosen, who now became the leader of Jewry, someone who was a Sadducee, who was similar to that, who was assimilated, and then one who was even more a radical assimilationist, Misyavin Menelaus, also bought the position, and it was under him that began the whole Hanukkah story of the forced assimilation. But during the time of Antiochus III, it seems that the Sanhedrin were the ones who were in control. There was a time of peace. Later on, when under the Hashmonaim, when Yanai died, who was the brother-in-law of Shimon ben Shetach, and after he died, Yanai's wife, who was the sister of Shimon ben Shetach, Shlomtzion, that she took over, there's also unprecedented peace. What they wanted here in the time of Yoichah ben Zakkai was to deal with the Romans and also to have a period of peace, and it would be run by Torah law. It says, and it would be, there would be no corruption. And the Romans, because of this problem of the siege, they know that they'll have to tremendous sacrifice to be victorious, and it'll be a small price for them to pay let the Sanhedrin be in charge, to get rid of the corruption and the bribery. That was their hope. This is how Rav Isaac HaLevi understands this. Of course, they were undermined by the other people, the freedom fighters, the Zibaryonim. And this is what happened. And then they arose and burnt the stores of wheat and barley. The rabbi said, you'll not succeed. But they said, they went and wanted to force the fight. And they had, according to the Gemara, Nunvova, Madalef, and Gittin, they had stores of provisions that would last for 21 years. They had the minimum. They had wheat and barley, the stores. They had stores of oil and wine. And they had stores of firewood. So minimally, they would have survived a siege. But then, it says that they burned the siege. Then a famine ensued. Well, people who are starving are not good soldiers. And they eventually they were not able to beat back the Romans, and they failed. Yoichah ben Zakkai saw the imminent failure. So it says, it continues on, Basikra, that there's father of the Sikari. The head of the Biryonim Yerushalayim was the son of the sister of Yoichah ben Zakkai. The latter sent him to him saying, there's a Yoichah ben Zakkai saying, come to visit me privately. When he came, Abba Sikri came, Yoichah ben Zakkai, he says, Yoichah ben Zakkai said to him, how long are you going to carry on in this way and kill all the people with starvation? He replied, so Abba Sikri says, what can I do? If I say a word to them, they'll kill me. So it's indicative of the kinds of people they're dealing with. He said, devise some plan for me to escape. Perhaps I should be able to save a little. He said to him, his plan was pretend to be ill, and let everyone come to inquire about you. Bring something evil smelling, something that's decaying, something dead. So it's a smell of death. And put it by you so they will say you're dead. Let then your disciples get under your bed. In other words, to carry the bed over here, the mita means the casket, no others. So they shall not notice that you're still light, since they know that a living being is lighter than a corpse. The question is, why that's so? Well, Maisa, they're saying the Metzias is, you can tell, carrying someone living and someone. So he did so. He followed those instructions. And the people at large assumed that now he was dead. There came public pronouncement of the death. And Rabbi Eliezer went under the bier from one side to carry it, and Rabbi Yeshua from the other side. When they reached the door, and as they wanted to leave Yerushalayim, because Ein Lonin es Hameis, you're not allowed to keep the dead in Yerushalayim, so they wanted to bury him outside, and they would have normally allowed that. But they were afraid that this was a ruse, that this was a trick. Some men wanted to put a lance through the bier, and they knew Rabbi Yoichah ben Zakkai was part of the peace party. In other words, they wanted to make peace with the Romans. So they wanted to put a lance through the bier, and he said to them, this is Abba Sikra, because he was going with him, it's his uncle, shall the Romans say they pierced their master? What will the Romans say about you? That you're barbarians. They'll fight you with no, they'll put everything against you, because they'll treat you like you're not human. They wanted to give him a push, at least push him if we hear a sound, a groan. He said to them, shall they say they pushed their master? In other words, there's spies all around here. They opened a town gate for him, the Shar, and he got out. In other words, according to one version, they really took him to the cemetery. There was nobody there in the cemetery. Then he got out of the casket. When he reached the Romans, he said, peace to you, O king, peace unto you, O king. I mean, it could be it wasn't like the casket that they think. Maybe it was like, the Yerushalayim, but Okoponim, he was covered. A messenger, yes, a peace to you. And they had this, the Gemara, if you looked at his whole Arichas on the Gemara, he originally said to you, you're the king. He said, if I'm a king, why didn't you come earlier? And it was a whole argument back and forth between them. But eventually, at this point, a messenger came and says, stand up, get up, for the emperor is dead, and those of Rome decided to make you head of the state. I mean, it's a little more complex than that. There were those who vied for this throne. He had people for him, but of course there were people on the other side as well, and he had to fight his way to get to Rome eventually. But he was successful. He said, so he told Yechon Zenzaka, I'm now going. I'll send someone to take my place, which was his son Titus. You can, however, make a request of me, and I will grant it. Said to him, he asked for three things. Give me Yavnets, Torah scholars. From this, it would seem that the Sanhedrin, the Talmid Chachamim, had moved already to Yavna. It was not under siege. But he was afraid eventually they'll go to Yavna, they'll take over everything and destroy everything. You have to guarantee the Yavna and his Torah scholars will be left alive and thriving. The second, the family chain of Rabban Gamliel. In other words, you shouldn't look at it as an enemy because they're afraid of, independence. You should keep alive the Rabban Gamliel. In other words, the Rabban Gamliel is referring to Shoshilta Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel is referring to Rabban Gamliel HaZoken, the elder, who had been the famous and revered leader of Jewry. His son, Rabbi Shimon, is Shimon HaNerag, who was killed. There's a question of when. But his grandson, at that time later, became the Nossi. That's Shushilta, the chain of Rabban Gamliel. It's okay that it continue on. Don't harm that family. Basically, you're saying they're not a threat to you. They're also part of the peace party. And they're not a threat to you. And send physicians to heal Rabbi Tzadok. The Medrash says about healing Rabbi Tzadok, that eventually, they had to get Rabbi Tzadok out. It was a Sigvana Kuntz. It was not easy to get Rabbi Tzadok out. He had fasted for 40 years, and he was he was on the point of death. The Gemara describes that he would take a dried fig and suck out what remainder of the juice. They have some nutrition, but it's almost nothing. So they had to send soldiers to get him out. And it describes when they brought him out, Vespasian, Aspasia had not left yet. And he looked at him, and he was all skin, and he looked like the people that are ready, that came when the liberation of the concentration camps. Those were on the verge of death. Right? He says, for this, I had to put my soldiers in danger? Like they really had to go in and bring them out. So he said, this man, he said, look at him. If we had two, the problem is we only have one like that. If we had two, you wouldn't be here now. And the Gemara in Gittin describes how he healed him, like gradually they gave some nutrition and some carbohydrates, and they gave him just a little bit slowly that the stomach would start expanding and working. And one of the major problems of those who were liberated by the camps, because they had eaten so little, the body was really not ready to integrate. Right? And they were given by the Allies, that they came and liberated them. They gave them food in abundance, and they died from the abundance of food. So it was like, had to be done like through a doctor, and that's what Gemara described. The Gemara continues on, Rabbi Yosef, and some say Rabbi Akiva, applied to him the verse. He says to B'yechem and Zakkai, says, God turneth wise men backward to make their knowledge foolish. Says, says that they may be wise people, but Hashem influenced them to make them not wise and make wrong decisions. This is what either Rabbi Akiva or Yosef says. What the right thing should have been, he ought to have said to him, let the Jews off this time. He says that's really what he should have said. And according to Rabbi Akiva's opinion, he would have been successful. He, referring to Yochim and Zakkai, however, thought so that so much he would not grant, you know, to Tefasta Merula Tefasta. He says, Kuli Ha'eloyovet, he wouldn't do that much. But Tzolaportin Namiloyhevi, he said it's ridiculous, and then he would have been angry and would have left and he would have gotten nothing. So that was the reason Yochim and Zakkai. That was his reasoning, but Rabbi Akiva nonetheless felt that Hashem had made him think this way. You know, incorrectly, and had he thought correctly, he should have really asked for him to have left and the Romans, and really he should have sued for that peace, you know, that he had, that they had really originally wanted. So, Mitzvah Hashem, next year we'll continue. But now, are there any questions? Oh, you're asking what is the story with Kamsa Bar Kamsa? You know, we don't, you know, the difficulty in many of these agadathas is we don't have enough information to accurately be sure of anything that we're saying. Here we give Gemaras and we have Makairas and we have sources. We're not on firm ground. One thing we could say, this Bar Kamsa, whoever he was not from the Lamed Vav Tzadikim. That's for sure. And we could understand, knowing what he did at the end, we could understand at least the reasoning behind that the Chachomim, seeing that he was embarrassed so, did not say anything. Because evidently they knew what kind of a person he was. Yet Chazal say, you see the power of embarrassment, that was the last straw that brought the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And it was the embarrassment of what would seem to be a Sadducee, someone who is close to the, you know, the Herodians, the Romans, who was really, could understand, an enemy of the person who hosted this feast. And yet they had a taina because of the busha of embarrassment. It was interesting. Beyond that, we're not on firm ground. I once saw Rav Igdor Miller quotes from the Josephus wrote four books. One was, his first book was The War of the Jews, describing what occurred, at least his version of what occurred, destruction of the temple. He wrote a work subsequently called Antiquities, the Kadmonios, which is really a world history based on the Bible, Jewish history, from the beginning of time, all till his time, close to the Churban, Ad V'le'ad Bechlal, but not including, that he had covered already in the War of the Jews. He wrote a fourth book called Neged Apion, and it was against Apion, who was a defense against anti-Semitism. And he wrote a book, his autobiography. In his autobiography, he describes a person who was a Sadducee, Kamsus, the son of Kamsus. And Victor Miller wants to identify this to be the Bar Kamsa. In fact, we could understand the Kamsa and the Bar Kamsa. You know, his name was also Kamsa. But we wanted to see, there are two Kamsas. How do we know which Kamsa is which? Oh, that's the Bar Kamsa versus the Kamsa. I think that's how we understand. So according to that, really, he was a Sadducee. And he was, but had he not gone through all this embarrassment, he would have not done what he had done. So you see that really, as we're saying in this, you know, this thesis, that really how the Pharisees dealt with the other ones is really was crucial to what occurred.
That was the Tzaduki, not the
Yeah, that was a Tzaduki, but still, you know. Was a it gives you a sense of what happened, but since there is so little facts related to this, so there's room for much speculation. You know, one of the kashas that they deal with, and it's also interesting. Again, it's a prime for Jewish creativity. About this is, you know, the sort of kamsa and bar kamsa. So simply you say kamsa because that's the setting. That's how the shamash made the one who was sent made the mistake. But the kasha asks, was this kamsa shuldik? In other words, for he got, you know, he was named over here. So what was the problem here? There's all kinds of speculation. One very interesting one is that, and again, it's very interesting, the theories that are given. One interesting is Kamsa was his friend. So once a friend doesn't need any invitation. You have a simcha, a friend comes without an invitation. The fact is he needed an invitation. Everything came because he felt he needed him. You know, it's the creativity is, they're just, you know, there's just many, many theories here. But based on what's historically, one perhaps could say this, what I said. Any other questions? Okay, good Shabbos.